Episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
All right. Well, welcome everybody again to another episode of our show, bringing you another really fascinating guest today who is helping to create a better tomorrow on many unique fronts. Today, we have the honor of being joined by Dr. Ana Maria Cuervo, who is co-director of the Einstein Institute for Aging Research and a member of the Einstein Liver Research Center and Cancer Center. She serves as a professor in the Department of Developmental and Molecular Biology and the Department of Medicine Hepatology Component, and as the Robert and Renee Belfair Chair for the Study of Neurodegenerative Diseases. Dr. Cuervo studied medicine and also pursued her PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology at the University of Valencia. She did postdoc work at Tufts, and in 2001, she started her lab at Einstein, where she's been studying the role of protein degradation in aging and age-related disorders, with an emphasis on neurodegeneration and metabolic disorder. Her group is interested in broadly understanding how altered proteins can ultimately be eliminated from cells and their components recycled. Her group has been involved in linking various alterations in lysosomal protein degradation with different neurodegenerative diseases, including Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, as well as Huntington's disease. They have also shown how restoration of normal lysosomal function helps prevent the accumulation of various damaged proteins with age, ultimately demonstrating that the removal of these products is possible. They've been pioneering studies in the link between autophagy and cellular metabolism, the coordination of autophagy and glucose and lipid metabolism, as a variety of other metabolic disorders. In addition to her leadership in this area, Dr. Cuervo has been presenting her works on numerous national and international stages. She has served on numerous advisory panels, including the NIH Advisory Panel, the National Institute of Aging Scientific Council, and the NIH Council of Councils, and has been recently elected as a member of the NIH Board of Scientific Counselors and member of the Advisory Committee to the NIH Deputy Director. She has a list of other accolades, which would take up the whole episode if I go into them, but we are honored to have with us today. Dr. Ana Maria Cuervo, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Ira.
It's great having you. You have an amazing background, and I would really love to start off just by handing you the floor for a little bit to talk a little bit about the very beginning. In the sense, I was reading that you originally were interested in being a mathematician and ultimately went the way of biomedicine. But what got you interested in biomedicine, and what got you interested in, as you refer to, in biologically taking out the trash?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I was very interested in mathematics, but I like numbers, I like quantification, but unfortunately it was not so clear for my parents I can have a future on that, or at least to have a decent salary. And then I decided to go into medicine, but with the idea that I wanted to do research, and mostly because I was very fascinated by human physiology. I know that we break apart with the time, but I still consider the human body such a perfect machine. And I wanted to know much more at the cellular and molecular level. And then as I was doing the typical rotations through medicine, I become very interested in geriatrics, and mostly because it seemed a very depressing situation. I mean, I'm talking about Spain in the early 90s. And of course, any kind of intervention to extend lifespan was not still in the picture. And the idea is that geriatrics was mostly palliative care. It's like make sure people are comfortable, but there is nothing that can be done about all the functional loss. And then when I decided to do research, the first time I did during medical school, I did research in electrical nerve conduction, mostly in animals, because it was interested for the lab that I was in. But then as I was taking a lab to do my thesis, there was an investigator, Erwin Neck, that mentioned the word aging. So that was the only one that have ever said anything about aging during the research talks. And then he convinced me that poor cellular cleaning was the basis of aging. So I did my thesis with him. I was extremely fortunate because he's an amazing scientist, and he taught me all the basics of scientific research, the method, but also we never reached to the aging part in my thesis, but we were very lucky that we started to collaborate with a group here in the States, in Tufts University in Boston, with Fred Dyce, the latest Fred Dyce. And he was working also in cellular cleaning, but he was doing work on aging. So I had this amazing experience as graduate student to spend winters in Valencia in Spain doing my thesis with Erwin Neck, and coming during 3 months during the summer to Boston to continue my studies and try to figure out if what we were looking at was similar model, if it was different, if it was something that we could explore together. And fortunately for me, the process was the same, but instead of competing, these two investigators decide to collaborate. And I was the one who benefited of all that collaboration. And then after I finished my thesis, Fred Dyce in Boston convinced me to just go for a couple of months, just to wrap up the last story and then move on to my next interest. But I think he knew that my interest was really into this cellular cleaning, lysosomes and aging. And I never left the topic. I stayed with him during my postdoc, and then I started, as you say, my lab in Einstein, focused on cellular cleaning and aging.
Excellent. Excellent. And you know, I was reading a recent interview that you gave in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and you were talking, you know, originally, you know, back in the day when you first started out this, there was this general understanding that this process, you know, involved the lysosomes, which we sort of viewed as these garbage containers, and it was sort of a general process. But as you've been spearheading and sort of really thought leading in this area, the bucket that is autophagy has really been, you know, divided up into many different areas in terms of the chaperone mediated, which we'll get into in a little bit, as you know, sort of where you're spending a lot of your effort, but also, you know, broadly the macroautophagy, the microautophagy, this crinophagy, which is kind of new and not as well understood. Talk a little bit about sort of the time that autophagy, as you've been studying it, has diversified into all of these unique areas in our and your understanding, and obviously teaching us, and really how selective and really refined a process is on all these different levels.
Yeah, so the field when I started my thesis was in a very different stage, and I think it's one of those cases in which ignorance is a blessing, because I was an MD. I didn't know better that nobody believed that lysosomes can selectively pick up the trash. Everybody had this preconceived idea that lysosomes are like bulldozers inside the cell. It's like whatever is there gets trapped. And, you know, you get the good and the bad, but it's for the good of eliminating the bad. And then basically Erwin Neck, my thesis director, had this idea that if that will be the case, when you look at how long proteins are in the cell, all of them should go at the same time, right? Because you have this random process of cleaning, and that there should be some selectivity. And I guess, as I say, I was the only ignorant student that said, sure, let's test it. So we started to do that. And, you know, it was, for me, it was very interesting because it was the first time that I was working in the lysosomal field. And as I say, I didn't have the baggage or the background that other people have, that that was a no. So we started to do experiments, and they kind of showed that if you put two or three proteins, some of them are picked up more selectively. And we did it by isolating these organelles. And then, as I say, we partnership with Fred Dyce, that was the other crazy nut in the other part of the Atlantic, that was also talking about selectivity and in lysosomal degradation. And, you know, li little by little, it became more accepted as we were gathering information. But I have to say that there was a lot of reluctancy about that. But then, you know, we were probably very lucky that we were looking at this very selective process that, as you mentioned, is called chaperone-mediated autophagy now. We gave them that name in 2000. But this, there were other types of cleaning, lysosomal degradation, as you mentioned, macroautophagy, microautophagy, and all of them were considered to be non-selective. But by the very late 90s and beginning of 2000 is when three different groups in three different parts of the globe, that's the beauty when these things happen, right? They coincide in a finding. So the group of Yoshimori Oshumi, Japan, the group of Dan Klionsky here in the States, and the group of Michael Tam in Germany, they all did screenings in yeast, trying to look for who are these players of this autophagy process. And they identify really the molecular players, the molecular, the genes and proteins that participate in this process. And what that later, I mean, demonstrate is that all this set of genes can make this process very selective. So not only it was us with this little pathway there, but all of a sudden the field explode because macroautophagy, that was the one that most people were familiar, all of a sudden was not like this random process. It becomes very selective, and the receptors, who is picking up the trash, how is the trash being recognized from the good things inside the cell, all that wealth of information all of a sudden make very clear that autophagy in general, all these types of autophagy, macro, micro, CMA, can be very selective. And that has been the excitement of the last 10 years that really brought the field where we are now and brought the Nobel in 2016.
And you were, you've been, as mentioned, chaperone-mediated autophagy, which you defined. I mean, this has been where you've been focusing, and this is an extremely important component of, as you referred to, cellular homeostasis. It contributes to energetic cellular balance, cellular quality control. You can recycle amino acids, proteins, and so forth. In beginning of 2020, you published a paper entitled "Monitoring Spatiotemporal Changes in Chaperone-Mediated Autophagy in Vivo," and here you really drilled down to show, okay, as selective as this is, we go broadly now across organ types and different cells and different stresses, it even gets more selective. And I'd like you to just talk a little bit about sort of where we are in 2022. And I don't know if the right term is the autophagome or whatever you define is sort of the broad map of what autophagy looks like across, or CMA looks like across all our organs. But talk a little bit about sort of what we understand in terms of these spatiotemporal differences in 2022.
So it's a very interesting point, and I have to say we are still on the go. We still have so much to learn, and I think it's as everything in science, right? You have to start very reductionist. So we are all working, you know, most of these original studies were either fibroblasts because they are very easy to grow in culture, or liver, yes, because it's a big organ that you can get from the animals and you can study the process, and also because autophagy originally was identified as this process that gets mostly activated when you don't eat. So just as a little of for context, when you don't eat, you still need nutrients. You still need to synthesize proteins using amino acids. You still need sugars. You still need lipids. And the way that the cells cope with that is that they break down storage of proteins, lipids, and sugars that you have inside your cells. And autophagy is the one doing that. So that was a new from since the 60s, right? When the Duke discovered the lysosomes and autophagy the very first time. But what it was not clear is whether that's a generalized mechanism for all the cells. And as I say, We've been generalizing for a long time based on very few systems and yeast and flies and different experimental models have given us a little broader picture. But for mammals, I still think we have a lot to learn. So we have learned that autophagy, as you point out, the basal level of autophagy is something that occurs continuously every day in all your cells, but the basal level of autophagy is different depending on the cell type, depending obviously in the organ, so inside the organ, but also depending on the region of the organ. So something that we as a field are very interested is trying to understand, is this all related to the nutrient availability? I mean, areas that have less access to the bloodstream, do they have more autophagy as a way to get nutrients until they receive them from the blood? Or is this related to areas that are more prone to damage? I mean, you have organs like the heart that probably have the highest rate of oxidative damage, right? It's continuously contracting and pumping, and your mitochondria in the heart have to be always 100% up. So maybe the level of damage there requires higher autophagy on those particular cells than in others. So this is what we are trying to elucidate. But something that has changed a little the way that we do that is that our lab and other groups have developed now, as you point out in this 2020 paper, reporters, artificial fluorescent proteins that allow us now to look at all the organs without having to take organs, smash them down as we were doing, and separating these lysosomes. So that has provided this amazing view. And also, we and other labs are extending it to understand when does this autophagy fail? And if it fails in particular diseases, what are the primary cells affected? Because something to understand is that when you have a failure on autophagy, eventually it's going to affect many more cells than the original ones because there is this cross communication about cells. And if one of them is stressed and poorly cleaning, at the end, the garbage, if you don't clean at home, eventually it accumulates and it passes to your neighbor. So it's part of this process. So what we are understanding now is that using these reporters, these fluorescent proteins, we can see what are the cells that are primarily affected in some of these diseases that you mentioned at the beginning, neurodegenerative conditions or metabolic disorders. And this becomes important when we think about therapeutics, because I always say to fix something, you have to know first where is the problem and what is really the problem, what is not working. And I think those kind of tools and animal models and systems that we have developed will help with that. But as a follow-up of this 2020 study, now we are going into even deeper complexity that is like not only how is autophagy in all these different organs, but also how does it change in our case, for example, with physiological aging? I mean, are the changes in autophagy the same in all the organs? Or does the rating with each organ age somehow related to the rate in which autophagy declines? And also the last thing that we are incorporating and we are wrapping up now this study is sex differences. We have realized that there is a lot of differences in between males and females about autophagy. But interestingly, we all think about hormones and other aspects, but there are even cell intrinsic difference. We can get cells from male and a female. You put it in culture and they still maintain this different autophagy, even there are not hormones or difference in the rest of the culture. So I think there is cell intrinsic properties about this control of autophagy that are going to become important. Again, thinking on therapeutics. I mean, we are designing therapeutics for white males and we still have to figure out how to do therapeutics for a much more diverse population. We still have an issue that is, how are we going to address diversity using experimental mouse models? So that's why we are moving, I think, the field. And when I say we in this case, I really mean the autophagy field or the proteostasis field in trying to move into human-related models that can approach this diversity. I mean, the high risk that you have, for example, in particular populations of some diseases, does it relate to their levels, the basal levels of autophagy? And I think that will help us to do a much more personalized therapeutic approaches.
Absolutely. And one of the one of the targets in all this, and obviously that work is going to give you potentially thousands of new targets, but the one that you've really been spending a lot of time on recently is this lysosome-associated membrane protein LAMP2, which is on the membrane of the lysosomes and is involved in the shuttling process of some of these damaged proteins. And one of the areas, and you started publishing actually back in 2013 on how retinoic acid receptor is involved in sort of the signaling that goes on with this LAMP2 and the amount of chaperone-mediated autophagy that happens. Very recently, you published this study on retinoic acid receptor alpha co-repressor interaction and studies of retinal degeneration. And I'm always very intrigued when retinoic acid comes up because it seems like it has a really interesting place in a lot of areas of rejuvenation. We just did a couple episodes sort of from the regenerative biology space. Retinoic acid receptor is extremely important in limb regeneration and in tissue patterning. Talk a little bit about sort of what got you focused on retinoic acid receptors back in 2013 and take us a little bit to the current studies because you're making a lot of the waves of the news with those.
Yes, we were interested in trying to ramp up a chaperone-mediated autophagy. So we wanted to enhance it because we have shown experimentally that if we mimic the decrease that we see with age in this process, so first we showed that chaperone-mediated autophagy decrease with age. We know some of the players, like this LAMP2A protein that you have described, that are particularly affected. And then we also see this decline is even more accelerated in neurodegenerative conditions, such as an Alzheimer or in Parkinson's disease. So the whole idea is that maybe the aggravating effect that aging has on those diseases, those are diseases of aging, might be in part related to this decline on CMA. So we wanted to develop mostly chemical tools. It was like, it's great that I think we might be able to develop then in real therapeutics, because as an MD, as you can imagine, that will be like a big culmination of all that we have been doing. But initially we wanted chemical tools that allow us to modulate autophagy, enhance the chaperone-mediated autophagy, and see if that was enough to slow down some of the aspects of aging and especially progression of age-related diseases. So the problem with that is that how are we going to do it? I mean, we knew that this LAMP2A decrease, and we can genetically put an extra copy and show that then you have better organs with better function that responds better to stress, even in all animals. But at least in 2022, I don't think we are ready to do gene therapy as a prophylactic approach in 50-year-olds, so they don't have some of these age-related diseases. So we kind of wanted something chemical. And the way that we want is to look for signaling mechanisms that control CMA and look mostly for inhibitors. So doing a general screening through CRISPR, we found that retinoic acid receptor alpha is a physiological inhibitor of CMA and that chaperone-mediated autophagy. And that doesn't mean anything bad. I mean, you always need to have a break for anything that you activate. So this is the normal function. But we kind of thought that maybe we can take advantage of that finding. And if we are able to inhibit retinoic acid receptor, then you take out the brake on CMA, and hopefully that will give us the increase that we wanted. But as you nicely point out, retinoic acid receptor is very important. The signaling through this nuclear receptor is very important for cellular homeostasis, neuronal development. There are many, many aspects that are under this pathway. So I was very lucky to team up with an amazing chemist, Everis Kabathiotis, that is also a professor at Albert Einstein. And he basically, or we basically said to look for compounds that can modulate the signaling and the retinoic acid receptor that only affects chaperone-mediated autophagy. And I have to say, we have our doubts that that was going to work because there are about 275 genes that are under this receptor. So you have this major receptor, controls many processes in the cell. And here we are trying to find how are we going to dissect what is the part that controls CMA. But through the amazing chemical biology that he that Ebris have been doing, we were able to dissect a small pathway. So it's a new class of molecules that all of a sudden, out of these 275 genes, they were that are under the retinoic acid receptor. When we add them, they were only touching about 32, and 13 of them happened to be chaperone-mediated autophagy regulators. So it was one of those things that is, oh, look at that. Of course, the screening was set to discard anything that was touching anything farther than chaperone-mediated autophagy. It took us 7 years. I make it sound very quick, but Ebris probably will not agree because it took a long time. But what we had done, or what he has really done, is continuous refinement of the molecules to make sure that there were not these other side effects that are part of the normal function. So that gave us a first generation of molecules that we could use in vitro in our cells in culture, and we were able to activate CMS. So I was already happy because, you know, we have the chemical tools that we needed for our studies. But of course, at the end of the day, we wanted to develop something that we can use in vivo. So through a lot of medicinal chemistry, we optimize these molecules now that can be used, as you saw in the very, very recent, like 2 weeks ago, yep, a manuscript that can be given orally. Of course, it's still experimental mouse models. I want to be very realistic about what we have achieved. We're still not giving this in people even, and getting a lot of letters from patients. And, you know, I feel why they are so interested, but we're still in experimental models. But the compounds have very good biodistribution. They cross the brain-blood barrier, at least the ones that we want to use for targeting neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer and Parkinson. We have been giving them for more than 12 months now. I keep adding, as people ask me, because we keep them on these those compounds to animals, and that will be like, you know, at least one third of your life in people. And we haven't seen any major toxicity in any of the organs. Of course, we keep continuously investigating on that. We have given it to all animals. That I think that's very important because many of these compounds are going to go to elders, right? If we decide to do a treatment. So pharmacokinetics and everything is very different in all organisms. And it's something that we wanted to make sure that then all this lack of toxicity that we were so excited about in a young animal also reproducing all, and they still maintain the beneficial effect. We have tested in experimental models, two different models for frontotemporal dementia, tauopathies like Alzheimer's disease. We have also done some work now in Parkinson's disease with these compounds, and the most recent work was in degenerative diseases of the eye, so retinitis pigmentosa, and again, all mouse models, and they seem to do very well. So we can cure an animal. We still have a long way to go for people, but the good thing and the reason why we are doing that, I mean, I don't think I'm going to be the one developing the drug. I don't have the capabilities. We are a cell biology lab to use in people, but the advantage is that, you know, these compounds have been now licensed. So there is a company behind that that is developing. And also I hope the work has called the attention of other pharma that might be interested in targeting, maybe through other mechanisms. And it doesn't have to be necessarily through the retinoic acid receptor, but maybe they can come up with other ways to enhance CMA, because I think at least the proof of concept is there that if we prevent the decline on CMA activity in all animals, that seems to slow down some of the aspects of aging and also slow down course of age-related diseases that we have looked so far.
No, it's very exciting. I mean, and you know, you're hitting, as you were saying, broad, in this case, neurodegenerative targets of interest. It's a small molecule. We're not, you know, as you were saying, we're not ready for gene therapy to do this yet. Yeah, I mean, it's drug development 101. Yeah, it takes time, but nonetheless, I mean, you've made amazing progress since sort of the initial hypothesis in the literature. So that's very exciting to see. You know, and the other thing I was, you mentioned at the beginning, sort of the, you know, how autophagy gets regulated up and down based on sort of simple things that we do in our life, whether we don't eat enough or certain stresses and what have you. However, recently, and this was May of 2022, you published this other fascinating paper, and you introduced us to another new term here, chronophagy. The title of this paper is Circadian Remodeling of Proteome by Chaperone-Mediated Autophagy, and here you sort of take us into the circadian clock potentially as a tool. You talk about the sort of the subproteome that manifests at different times of day related to CMA. Talk a little about what you got interested in looking at the circadian clock and connected to a CMA, if you would.
Yeah, so I'm very glad that you brought that up because as I was talking about the spatial temporal differences on CMA, I was like, oh, I'll wait for the time of the day. That also changed, but so now we can touch upon that. So actually, for us, the interest in circadian, it also originates from the interest in aging. As you know, as you get old, your circadian rhythm for all kind of activities get quite altered, and it's intrinsically linked also to many of these new neurodegenerative conditions. So I have to say I was never brave enough to adventure into that or put a grant because everything that we do has to be supported by some kind of money. So I never put a grant into looking at the circadian rhythm, but it was something that since we did the work in the animals, I was like, this is gonna change during the day. And then I was very lucky that one of the graduate students that decided to declare to do the thesis in my lab, initially we were gonna do some work in centenarians, and I was telling all that, and he said, that's all okay, but I want to do circadian rhythms. And I was like, ooh, you just have to give me that to have an excuse now. So I have to say, well, he wanted to do that. So basically we have some funding and support to do other things, like more like freedom to do things. And this was part of the freedom. We decided to do circadian. I think he generated a very, very exciting story. Of course, his circadian rhythm probably is all messed up by now because he was coming to the lab every 6 hours to do experiments because he had to go through the hours. So imagine going to the lab to isolate lysosomes at 2 in the morning. But the beauty of that is that I think in addition of showing that CMA is circadian and autophagy is circadian and explain how some of these changes occur. The other important thing is that we were always very curious why when you block an autophagy pathway, I mean, you have the others. And sometimes the others do the cleaning, but why do you still have a phenotype? Why do you, these models in which we block CMA, they still have metabolic problems, so they still have memory problems, so their neurons are dying. So what we realize is that it's not only important to do autophagy, but the time that you do it. And the main reason, and going back to the selectivity that we discussed before, is because we have found, and as a field, in this case, it's not only on that paper, but I think it has become a theme, that you not only activate autophagy to remove damaged proteins, but you can activate this process to eliminate fully functional proteins to terminate whatever they are doing in the cell. And that's when timing becomes very important, right? Because imagine that you want to do synthesis of lipids and because your cells need lipids, but all of a sudden you have to stop it. So if you eliminate the enzymes that participate in lipogenesis, that's a good way to terminate the process very quick, very clean. And then you can also address thing of autophagy is very conservative. So you can use the pieces of those enzymes that you are breaking down to stop their function to synthesize others that you might need. So everything is about recycling. But in that case, the time at which you do that, the time at which you remove the garbage might not be so important as far as you do it from time to time, but the time at which you stop the function of a protein becomes completely critical. You don't want to stop synthesis of your lipids at the moment that you need more energy, or just to continue with this example. So if all of a sudden you don't have CMA and then macroautophagy comes to the rescue, but it's doing it at the wrong time, it might be removing all these, terminating the function of all these proteins that are still needed to be functional for the cell. And I think by doing those experiments every 6 hours, we realize that the timing at which you degrade each of these proteins is extremely important. And then, of course, the extrapolation of that is that if therapeutically we want to manipulate these pathways, as we all want, timing is going to be also very important. And it's very important to understand what happened when you enhance one pathway, what happened to the others. We don't want the others to become lazy now. We still want them to do their function. So I think in the broad spectrum of how are we going to tackle autophagy as a therapeutic, those are considerations that need to be put on the table, right? About timing and about the mechanisms that we are going to use to activate these processes.
And so we have timing, we have unique mechanisms, spatiotemporal differences, and so forth. One other area that I know you're extremely well known, sort of Once again, for taking out the trash, but you've also published, and you mentioned before, in terms, there's a balance to all of this, and you don't want to go too far, obviously, in that direction. You have published, and once again, I'll just point out one of the recent papers, chaperone-mediated autophagy controlling proteomic and transcriptomic pathways to maintain glioma stem cell activity. And here, you've written about sort of autophagy involved in the sort of the development of stemness. And once again, I mentioned some of the papers I've seen about autophagy related to regeneration, which once again brings that in. But here you're bringing in another angle that, okay, when it comes to things like cancer, we got to be a little careful because there's a balance on both sides. Talk a little bit about some of the different activities that you're involved in here, because I think we don't hear about as much of this, but this is another important point of your portfolio.
Yeah, no, and I fully agree. And probably that's the part of like me trying to be extremely cautious about everything and trying to cover all the field to make sure that we don't end curing Alzheimer and developing cancer, right? That would be a very bad outcome. But you touch in very, very important points in cancer in general, because it's very well known that cancer cells, they also need autophagy. And sometimes they use it in their advantage, right? Because when you start like hitting with chemotherapy, radiotherapy, you're trying to cause damage. If they have good autophagy, they might be able to remove that damage and then don't die. That is ultimately the goal of those interventions. However, the relation of autophagy and cancer is much more complex that we all in the field initially thought about, because we thought is that, well, you block autophagy, cancer cells die because they cannot protect themselves. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as that. And then what also on the other side of the coin, what you were pointing out is that what about aging and cancer? I mean, we know that except for pediatric cancers, aging is the common risk factor of all kind of cancers, right? It's the most common factor. So then the idea is that what happened in autophagy with aging? We are saying that autophagy decreased, but then as you point out, we show that, for example, chaperone-mediated autophagy increasing cancer cells, even in an old organism. So how does it happen? So what we have found, and I think this is consistent with the idea that autophagy and CMA in this case is an anti-oncogenic mechanism. Because what happened is that in normal conditions, if you decrease CMA, for example, you become more prone to malignant transformation. So you really want your CMA at the right level, and if it's possible, upregulated or at least high in your normal cells. The difference is that once they transform, the cancer cells have developed unique mechanisms that we still don't know, and I think that will be very important to investigate, by which even this cell that was coming from an old organism and used to have very low CMA, because as you age, this decrease, once it transforms and it becomes a cancer cell, the same cell all of a sudden is able to upregulate CMA like there is no tomorrow. So this is very important because that means that, again, going back to the timing, we should really enhance or at least restore CMA activity to the level similar to when you were young, in part to prevent this oncogenic transformation. So the earlier the intervention, probably the better. But then once you have the intervention, you might have to be, once you don't have this luxury to act very early on, or at least by midlife, if you're acting in all organs, I think something that we have to be very aware is the possible risk of malignant transformed cells to benefit even more of this enhanced CMA. So part of the screenings on the studies that we have been done, one of the requirements is that the behavior of some of these tools are very different in transform and not transform cells. So I think that's a way to go about that. And these particular compounds, that's the case, activation occurs mostly in untransformed cells. And that's an advantage because then you will not be facilitating the cancer cells. But still, it's something that, we should try to use how smart cancer cells are and try to figure out how can if this cell yesterday was an old regular cell with very low CMA, all of a sudden it transform and is able to activate this pathway that we wanted to activate to start with in this old individual. So right now we are performing a lot of molecular dissection of activation of CMA during the transformation event that leads to cancer, and in collaboration with the group of Esperanza Arias, also at Einstein, with the idea of learning from the cancer cells how to activate CMA in regular and transformed cells.
No, that's exactly where I was going with that. But yeah, no, that's extremely exciting, and you know, once again, you know, speaks to your sort of the diversity of your the research portfolio and what you're focusing on that you have to take into to all this into account. So no, that's really very exciting as well. I want to ask you one other question. I think it was a couple of years ago, I was watching a presentation you gave, and the host of that show was asking you about sort of general, you know, how can we sort of grade or study how well our bodies are autophagizing in general. And you know, you're talking about sort of the development of biomarkers and so forth. And obviously, as you know, because you're the sort of the epicenter of the longevity bio space nowadays, these epigenetic clocks have gotten kind of a hot top become a hot topic in recent months. I was just wondering, are there in any interesting findings in terms of the autophagy epigenome, things that whether they're related to epigenetic clocks or the epigenome in general that inform you in the research on, hey, you know, this person or this animal's body, you know, that they're doing pretty well in the liver, but not so much in the brain, and you can have sort of an interesting sort of autophagy epigenome profiles, or is that sort of still something on in the portfolio that you're going to be working on?
Yeah, so for other autophagy pathways, I mean, there are already very, very elegant reports of epigenetic influence in regulation of macroautophagy. Still not on the context of longevity, but it's just a matter of time. But I've been very, very fortunate to be a good friend of Steve Horwath, that, as you know, is the one who developed the epigenetic clock. So we have an ongoing collaboration with
Excellent.
one of our mouse models, so with one of the leading persons in my lab is Dr. Immaculada Tasset. So basically, she has developed a mouse model in which we can enhance genetically, because it's as a tool, CME per life. So basically, what we are doing with Steve is to compare, because these animals live longer, they are healthier, they have less frailty, they are more resistant to any kind of stressors that we do. So it's kind of what you would like. But we want to know at the molecular level, okay, what of those hallmarks of aging are we really modifying? And do you need to add on different pathways? Or yeah, by adding CME, how many of those hallmarks? So with Steve, we have started, I mean, he has started to look at the clock in our animals. And for some, I mean, I have to say, it's not like everything is completely restored, because I think that's in part also the beauty. So you have changes, like some of the epigenetic changes in the clock that happen with age, that in these animals never happen. But then you also have, and I think those are going to be also interesting, changes that never happen in the young or in the old, but it happened in our model. But the outcome of our model is that they are healthier and live longer. So that means that this can be alternative mechanisms by which, if your epigenome is already alter and you cannot restore it to normal, at least there will be other parts of the epigenome that you can tackle to really compensate for that. So I think compensatory mechanisms are going to be something very important to explore in the future, because fixing things might not be always possible, but young organisms find a way to compensate when you damage one of these structures. So probably what we lost with age, and we have a couple of examples, is the ability to compensate. So if we identify those mechanisms, maybe we can enhance compensation, and that might be enough to have a positive outcome on longevity.
Very exciting. And what else is coming up for 2022? I know there's several aging conferences coming up. I think you're probably going to be at some of those, but any other things that I missed that are for the rest of the year, anything related to the company or other research components you're probably
Yeah,
pleased to
so for example, I can speak out about the drug development in CMA. So I know that Life Bioscience, that was the company that licensed these compounds, we work in close collaborations with them. So they are really, I mean, the plan is to go into clinical trials for macular degeneration. So we were talking about diseases of the eye that relate to aging, and as you know, macular degeneration is one of the big debilitating ones, especially the dry one, and there is not any therapeutic approach yet that has been successful. So they have done some studies in collaboration with Patricia Boya in Spain on that area. So I think there is going to be something coming, or at least the clinical trials initiating, because the The preclinical data looks very exciting. And also in general for the autophagy field, this is as part of talking with colleagues and attending meetings and, you know, all those things. I think that the space on therapeutics on autophagy is moving in what I think is the right direction, because initially, I mean, it was very good to have some tools that you can enhance autophagy, but not selectively. You are just increasing the initiation steps. And I think now, academia and industry interested in targeting autophagy are moving more into the selectivity. Can we enhance mitophagy, for example, degradation of mitochondria without touching your lipid droplets? Or can we just mobilize lipid droplets by autophagy without touching any other organ? And so I think in this case, I think that that's a very big step forward, that there are some exciting results coming on this ability to only modulate one type of autophagy. And also, I think there is more and more growing interest in this crosstalk that we talked before about the different autophagy pathways. So now that we have chemical tools to modulate one, before, you know, going big time into clinical trials, let's use these animal reporters and all these other systems to see what happened in different organs when you modulate this pathway, what happened to the other machinery. I mean, so far, and I have to say, I'm always an optimistic, and I have to say, just the genetic models, if anything, support that if you enhance, for example, it would prevent the decline on chaperone-mediated autophagy, the others don't become lazy. The others function better because now they don't have to take the load that CMA was not doing. So, you know, if you have four legs, it's going to be better than three in a chair. So now by restoring that one, the others even can, you know, function better. But, you know, this is, again, I'm making a general statement based on liver, fibroblast. So we really have to look if in all the organs that's the case before we go into, you know, therapeutics of autophagy. But, you know, the same conversation 5 years ago, I would have been more like, yeah, you know, there are going to be things. We have to hope for that. I don't think we have to hope. I am seeing a lot of activity in this field right now, and also a lot of interest for the autophagy field and proteostasis field in aging and healthy lifespan, that at the end of the day is what, you know, we are all interested. So I think that's going to give a big push in the coming years.
Outstanding. Really outstanding. It's a fascinating journey you've been on the last few decades with this, and really wishing you the best with all of it now that, you know, you're at the frontier of moving these compounds forward, getting more selective, getting a broader set of potential therapeutic interventions. So it's really exciting times. And once again, wishing you all the best with this. For everybody that is going to be listening to this particular episode of the show across the podcast or watching on the YouTube channel, again, you've been listening to Dr. Ana Maria Cuervo, co-director, Einstein Institute for Aging Research, member of the Einstein Liver Research Center and Cancer Center, also professor, Department of Development and Molecular Biology, Department of Medicine and Hepatology, and Robert and Renee Belfer, Chair for the Study of Neurodegenerative Diseases, doing really amazing things across the diseases of aging and aging in general. Dr. Cuervo, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to update us and fill us in on all these exciting initiatives. Obviously, thank you for doing them. And as we like to say on our show, thank you for helping to create a better tomorrow for so many people out there via what you're doing. Really great story.
Thank you very much for having me. And of course, the credit, I'm just the storyteller, as you know, the credit goes to all the people that has been in the lab during these last 20 years doing the day-to-day of getting these projects to fruition. Thank you very much.
Great seeing you.